All right. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for coming out so early on a Friday morning. Wow. In the first talk of today, I'm going to be introducing you to some advanced MVVM concepts. It is marked as a level 300 session. Yesterday in Belgium, it was a level 400 session. I don't know why. it depends, of course, a bit on your knowledge about MVVM already, and of course Windows 8 as well. I'm going to do an introduction of MVVM that will take about 10 minutes, and we'll take it from there so that no one falls overboard. Let me first introduce myself. So my name is Gilles Kleren. I work in Belgium at Ordina. Is there any colleagues of mine here? Normally they don't come to my sessions. I don't know why. Anyway, so I work at Ordina, and I also work for Pluralsight. I also do lots of stuff for Microsoft as an MVP and a regional director. This is my blog, my email, my Twitter. Take note of the blog if you want to download the code afterwards, as well as the slides. Everything is going to be on there. So that's snowball.be. First, maybe a little bit of a disclaimer. While I was in the speaker room, let's say half an hour ago, my laptop died. I don't know what happened, so I think it short-circuited or something. It started up again after 10 minutes or so, so I'm not sure if it's going to last the entire day. So I lent a MacBook from someone else, so we have a backup, so if we have to switch in the meantime, I'm sorry for that. So what are we going to do today? So as mentioned first, a very small introduction that will take us about 10-15 minutes to get through. First I'm going to make the link between modern UI and Windows 8 and MVVM. Then a very small overview of MVVM, the concepts, things like commanding, the view model locator pattern, and messaging. And then we'll dive deep in a complete architecture. So I'll show you an application architecture of, let's say, a real-world scenario. I'm going to show you where I use dependency injection for that. I'm going to show you how I do navigation in terms of MVVM. I'm going to show you how I do data access based on a data repository, and I will combine that with MVVM. We're going to take a look at how we, once we have that data, how we can data bind it to the Windows 8 controls. I'm going to show you how we can work with contracts in combination with MVVM, and also we're going to take a look at tiles. We'll take a look at local tiles. We'll see if we have time for push notifications. I'm going to show you how you can manage the state of an application, again based on MVVM, and we'll finally try to unit test everything that you've set up during the rest of the talk. So let's dive straight in, and I'm going to start by giving you a link of modern UI to Windows 8 and MVVM. So modern UI is totally different. Windows 8 applications that we have to build with Metro or modern UI or Microsoft Windows 8 store style. I don't know the correct name anymore. So we'll say Metro, and I get sued afterwards anyway. So Metro is a complete break with the past. There is many new concepts that we have to learn and that we have to apply when building Windows 8 applications. Think of the content before Chrome principle. Everything is content on the screen. There's not that many buttons. There's not that many controls on the screen. The entire application is filled with content. The applications are also running in full screen. We can put them in snap view. We can put them in field view, but most of the time, they're actually taking up the entire screen. The concept of a window is basically gone. We don't really have windows on the screen. We have one application on the screen. The fact that we have to take into account that an application can be in a different orientation, that the user can rotate the screen while he's using that. We didn't have to do that with WPF applications, for example. Windows is not really Windows anymore. Windows is now Pages instead of Windows. There's new ways of allowing users to work with applications. Users have to use touch. Users have to use an application bar because the content is important, not the Chrome. Users have to use the contracts to do stuff with other applications, like sharing data or searching within the application. There's the life cycle of an application that is totally different. The tile management, all new things that we have to think about when we build real-life Windows 8 applications. Now, we could do it just like we've been doing it for many years, but we can also do what we've learned in other technologies based on XAML and C#. Many of the apps that are today in the store are being built with XAML. The largest part of apps that is in the store today is built with XAML and C#. Now, conceptually, XAML hasn't changed. We have been using XAML for many years now in WPF, in Silverlight, and Windows Phone. And conceptually, things like a data context, data binding, the commanding itself hasn't changed. There are new concepts that we have to take into account, like the lifecycle, like the navigation, and that's where we're going to focus on. And doing these things with MVVM, building those applications with MVVM, is really a good idea. RFID, because if you know NVVM already from another technology, again, you will we will be able to apply those concepts in Windows 8 applications as well. And if you move to an HTML5 project, you can also apply your knowledge there, because things like Knockout.js, they are also based on the principle of NVVM. So it's really a good idea to build your applications using NVVM. So I'm going to first give you, let's say, a 10-minute high-level overview of NVVM, just explaining you the concepts so that no one falls overboard. If you know everything about NVVM already, take a nap for 10 minutes. I'll wake you up afterwards. So what is NVVM? NVVM is actually nothing more than an architectural pattern, which is, in fact, based on the presentation model of Fowler. And also, it's basically an evolution of the MVC pattern. And it was invented by a guy named John Gossman. You see a picture of him there. He was a guy of the WPF team, and he invented his NVVM pattern, or he described the NVVM pattern way back already in 2006, I think. It is basically leveraging the power of SAML. Things like data context, data binding, actually make NVVM possible. It's based on the concepts like data binding, like commanding, that are part of SAML, and they make the concept of NVVM possible. And it actually became popular with Silverlight. It was already invented, like I said, with WPF, but it really became common knowledge when people started building Silverlight applications. And then they used it also to build Windows Phone applications, and now also Windows 8 applications should be built with NVVM. Sorry. Now, the main goal of building an application using NVVM is basically this, that you have your developer and your designer that can do their work and don't interfere with each other. The one is sitting on one side of the wall, making his design, he throws it over the wall, and the other one can work with it. The coder can actually write his code. Now, I know in practice that is not really true. I do projects with NVVM. You don't always have a designer. But in general, the concept that NVVM will deliver you is a cleaner separation of your UI code from your actual code. Now, we haven't been doing that. We have been doing things in the past that we aren't proud of. We have been writing code that is really untestable, not really maintainable, and, in fact, just a mix of UI stuff with code. And what we've been doing is we've been writing code in code behind. And we've been doing other things that we are now regretting. So that is how we are writing how we were writing our code before this session, let's say. We have been writing code that contains a lot of XAML, code in the code behind, event handlers, and that code in the code behind goes directly to the data model. And going directly to the data model is okay, but the main problem is in the fact that your code behind is containing everything. And try testing that. There is dependencies on UI controls, there's dependencies on going to the data model, and it's really hard to test code in isolation. Writing unit tests on this kind of code is really hard. Now, in 2013, it seems that we became a bit smarter, although I'm not sure. And so we are now writing our code a bit differently. What you see here now is that is basically the principle of NVVM in code. You still have your view, you still have your XAML. There's a tiny bit of code behind. I'm not going to say that your code behind should be empty. There are people that say your code behind must be empty at all. No, I don't think that's true. There should be code in the code behind. Now, what code should be in the code behind? Code that actually does things with the view. Things like setting focus or something. That should be still in your code behind. But the main difference is, of course, the view model. And that view model is, let's say, an abstraction of the view that contains state and operations. And your view is going to bind on that view model using data binding and using commanding. And your view model is the thing that actually talks with the data model. And there should never be a direct link between your view and your data model. So the building blocks of MVVM, so the model view view model pattern, are the view, the view model, and the model. So the view is basically very simple. That is the XAML code. There can be a bit of code in the code behind, but mainly this is the XAML representation. This is what the user will interact with. And it will bind on the view model using data binding and using commanding. You shouldn't have a lot of event handlers. Certainly what you shouldn't have in your code behind is things that does anything with the model. Because what you're trying to achieve with NVVM is the fact that your code becomes much more testable. And once you try doing stuff from your code behind directly with the model, you are basically interfering with that principle. Then the view model is, of course, the most important aspect of the MVVM pattern. It is the link between the view and the view model. It is an abstraction of the view. What used to be in your code behind is now entirely moved to your view model. That is not 100% true, but that's basically what it boils down to. The view model is the link between your view and your view model, and your model, and it will actually do the interaction with the model and prepare everything so that the view can bind upon it using data binding and commanding. So it contains state and operations. State is the things that, like lists that we're going to bind to and selected items that we're going to bind to. Operations are the commands, and those are the things that used to be in your code behind. I think I said everything, yeah, okay. Then the model, so the view model interacts with the model. The model is basically your data representation. And this can be quite a lot of things. It can be like a DTO, it can be a proxy, although I don't advise you to directly use your proxy as your data model. You should probably build some layer on top of it to have some local data model that you're going to interact with. The model doesn't know the view model. That's an important aspect as well. The view model knows the model, but the model doesn't know the view model. In the same way, the view knows the view model, but the view model does not know the view. And that's how you separate things in several layers. Now, how do these two link know each other? Well, there should be a link, of course. How does the view know the view model? There are several ways of doing that. The view needs to find its data, its model, its view model. And basically what the view model is going to become, it's going to become the data context for the view, so that the view can actually bind upon it. Now, there's two ways of doing that. You can do that statically, meaning that directly in your XAML code, you're going to say in your view, you have to go take this view model as your data context. Or you can do that dynamically. Basically, at runtime, you push in a different view model so that your view can bind upon it. There's two ways of doing that. There's the view-first implementation and the view-model-first implementation. The name basically already says what it is. The view-first is basically the view gets created, and then the view model gets created. And the view-model-first is the opposite. The view model is created, and then the view gets selected. Now, how do you do that in practice? Well, you do that using something called a view model locator, and that is based on the locator pattern. The locator pattern is simply a class that will help you find your view model. And so your view model locator will help you to find its view model. That's doing that using the locator pattern. Technically, this is implemented as a class that has a property for every view model, so that a view can basically say to the view model locator, give me that particular view model, and I'm going to bind to that. We're going to see that in the code in just a second. In Windows 8 applications, the view model locator is very often used. It sometimes gave problems if you have like MDI interfaces, so multiple document interfaces. You don't really have that in Windows 8 applications. If you have that, then you still have to go to an IOC container. And we're going to use an IOC container in this application as well. Now, how do you do then your event handling? Because you still have things like clicking on a button that has to trigger an event, selecting something in a combo box that has to trigger something in some code. You do that using something called a command. When you look up the command pattern, it will basically give this description. It is a class that basically wraps everything to contain all the information to call a method at a later time. That's what the command will do. Commanding is available in WinRT using the iCommand interface, which basically is a very simple interface. It contains just three things. It contains an event handler, can execute changed. It has two methods, the execute and the can execute. The execute will actually contain the code that used to be in your event handler, and that is the code that is going to be triggered when the command is firing. The can execute returns a Boolean value that says whether or not the command can be executed at a specific time, and the event should be raised when the value of that can execute is changing, so that the UI knows that it has to change or reevaluate the can execute. Now, how do you use this I command then? Well, basically, you create an implementation of the I command, and then you create an instance of it on your view model, and then you let your view bind upon it. Now, this works only on some controls, because only a couple of controls, basically only the controls that implement or that inherit from button base, have a command property in XAML. Other controls need to use something like known as behaviors. Now, what is a behavior? A behavior is basically invented with Blend, and it was originally created as a way to allow designers to drag pieces of functionality using the Blend designer on particular elements. That's what the behavior can do. It's basically a block of code that promotes reuse that we can use or that we can attach on a XAML element. Now, behaviors allowed us also to use commanding on controls that didn't support the command principle or the command property. The problem is that Windows 8 doesn't know behaviors, and Windows 8 doesn't know triggers. So you cannot use them if you have to do stuff like, for example, switching the selection triggering selection changed event in a command. You can't do that using behaviors in Windows 8. So that's a bit of a problem. Now, there's someone from the Netherlands, Joost van Schaik, you may know him. He actually created something called the WinRT Behaviors NuGet library, NuGet package, that allows us using an attached behavior to still do the same thing. And so we can still use an event to command, so triggering some event and then using some event and then triggering a command. That's what you see here. So you have an event to command event to bound command behavior. So the event is here tapped, and that will actually trigger a specific command on the view model. So that's what you still can do then, and it basically works the same thing as we had to do it in other XAML implementations. The final thing that before we dive in is the fact that we need to use communication between view models. Now, communication between view models is a bit of a problem once you start having quite a lot of view models. In real-life applications, you'll end up with many view models. The most common scenario is having one view model. Now, if you want to communicate, if you want to let your several view models communicate with each other, things might get a bit messy, because what you're going to end up with is references from view model A to view model B to view model C, and try testing that in isolation. It's going to be really hard again. So what you're going to do is not create this kind of spaghetti, but you're going to use something known as the event aggregator or the mediator pattern. An event aggregator is simply a way of creating a common component where you're going to use a messaging system with. So instead of directly creating a reference from the view model on the left here to the two view models on the right, we're going to use a messaging system. An event aggregator, an event locator sits in between. What is happening here is the one here on the left, it will say, I need to raise an event. So I need to discuss something with view model 2 and view model 3 there on the right. Instead of creating a reference in this view model to these two view models on the right, we're going to use a messaging system. This one is going to say, I'm going to publish a message with the event aggregator. And the other ones are going to say, I'm subscribing to that event to the event aggregator to know when someone is raising that particular message. So this is what happens. This one pushes its message in, and the other ones are going to be notified about the message happening. And this way, we achieve loose coupling between the different view models. So those are, in fact, the most common things, the most common terms that you hear in combination with MVVM. So this was a very high-level overview, assuming that you already have done some MVVM and giving you the information that you need to follow along with the rest of the talk. So now we're going to dive in to a real application with a real architecture built with MVVM. So now before we sit down and think about an architecture, we should have some things to discuss and some things that we actually want to achieve with the architecture. Yeah? Simply saying, I'm going to build an architecture is not a good thing. You really have to think about what you're going to try to achieve. One of the things that MVVM promotes is the separation of concerns. The SOC principle, or separation of concerns principle, basically says every class should do one thing and one thing only. Yeah? It doesn't cost a thing to create a new class. You simply create a new class in Visual Studio. You don't see that on your bank account. You simply create a new class to do one thing. You shouldn't be creating view models that have 2,000 lines, because then probably the view models are doing too many things. A view model should do just enough to get the data ready for the view. And if you have to do some other thing at view model, you probably have to think about creating a new class. And we're going to do that. Another thing is loose coupling. Loose coupling between the several components, like with the messaging system, is an important aspect. We don't really want to create dependencies between the several items. We want to achieve loose coupling. And one way of doing loose coupling is, for example, using repositories for the data access, so that the data consumer is not linked with the actual data persistence code, but there is a layer in between the data repository. Also, we can achieve loose coupling between our components by using dependency injection. I'm going to use an IOC container that actually creates that manages all my dependencies in my code, and that will actually inject all the dependencies at runtime. In fact, I'm going to use interfaces throughout my code instead of concrete implementations, and my dependency injection container will manage all my dependencies. And finally, what we're going to achieve or try to achieve is the fact that the code is much more easily testable. We're going to write unit tests, and we're going to write the unit test using the fact that we have used loose coupling principles, separation of concerns, and the DI container. So that's what we're going to try to achieve. Now, the application that I've built is called Contoso Cookbook. You might, you probably know Contoso Cookbook if you've been doing some hands-on labs with Windows 8. Now, you may think, why is he showing Contoso Cookbook in an advanced talk? Well, actually, I selected Contoso Cookbook. It's a great implementation of Windows 8 principles, but it's not written using MVVM pattern. It's written entirely to learn, to teach you how to do Windows 8 things. So I recreated Contoso Cookbook from scratch so that it now actually uses MVVM. And it does the exact same thing as what the original Contoso Cookbook did. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to run it first for the people who've never seen it. Going to get you a bit hungry. So here you see some recipes. It's actually a simple grid view. You can click on Italian wedding soup. I don't know what that is. I don't know what, I don't want to know actually. You can flip through the individual recipes. You can do things like sharing them. All those things that are originally in the Contoso Cookbook sample are now here as well. There are a few extras. We may not have time to do them all. Take a look at the code at your own pace. You can also click on the recipe group header that takes you to the recipes, and there's also semantic zoom is also in there. So all the things that are originally available in Contoso Cookbook have been implemented here, I think, in a better way using MVVM. All right. So let's take a look at the architecture before we dive in. I'm going to collapse everything here. And let's take a look at the different projects in the solution. So as you see, it doesn't even cost a thing to create a new project. I'm a big defender of creating different projects for everything. Some people don't agree with me. It is my way of doing things. I'm not going to say this is a perfect implementation. Absolutely not. This is how I do things and how I may learn. I may teach you something in the way I do things. I'm not going to say that this is a perfect way. Far from that. It's certainly not true. So let's take a look at the individual projects. The Contoso Cookbook app is basically the Windows 8 application. It contains the views. So, for example, I have the recipe group view, which is XAML. And it contains a data context that indicates to which view model it is going to be bound. And for the rest, the code behind should be pretty empty. Let's take a look. As you can see, it is really clean. There is some view code in there. Again, this is not a sin to put some code in the code behind. But we're actually going to take a look at why this code is here later on. So the code behind is pretty clean, but there is some code in the code behind. Also in the app, we have the view model locator. The view model locator, I'm using MVVM Lite, but in fact, you could use any framework or you could build it entirely on your own. I'm using MVVM Lite here, but we're not going to see a lot of MVVM Lite here. I'm using the view model locator principle, which is also part of MVVM Lite. They promote that. In the view model locator, I have this instance factory thing. That is the DI container. We're going to take a look at that in just a second. The most important aspect for now is the fact that every view model is exposed as a public property on my view model locator. And that is how my view, actually finds its view model. The second project, let's collab this one. Second project are contracts. So contracts, I actually develop an interface for practically every class. Some people don't agree with that. For me, it works, again. So for example, I have interfaces on my model. I have interfaces on the services that I will be using. I have interfaces on the views and on the view model. So all those things have interfaces. So I'm actually developing the entire application by talking to interfaces instead of concrete implementations. The messages project, well, it contains messages. We're not going to use the messages here, so I'm not going to dive in that. The model contains the model that I've copied from the original Contoso Cookbook. It has a recipe and a recipe group. Let's take a look at the contracts, as it's easy to see how the model is basically built up. So I have the recipe group. The recipe group has an observable collection of iRecipes, and iRecipes is then the individual recipe. It is a demo still, so that is why the data is maybe already a bit in a format that it's easier to use in the UI. So you have the recipe group and then the observable collection of linked recipes. So those are the contracts. Then I have a repository. Repository we'll take a look at in here, so in a minute. So that is the recipe repository. The server, the services, that those are not important. That's basically if you want to go to the server side, that's my server side. Now, what I do want to mention here is that service client project. The service client only contains actual service references. I group all my service references, so the WCF services or whatever, in one project. So then if they change, I only have to change them in one location and not in all the projects that are depending on them. So I actually create a separate project to manage my service references. Then I have this services project. That's a very, very important one. We're going to use that quite a lot. So there is quite a lot of services in here, so classes that do individual things like doing navigation, doing sharing, and stuff like that. Then we have the shared. The shared only contains this instance factory, which is important. That's the DI management. I'm going to take a look at that in just a second. And then we have the view models. So the view models project contains all my view models. If you take a look at a view model, let's take a look at the recipe group overview, for example. That contains an observable collection of iRecipe groups. So that is state that is going to be exposed so that my view can bind on it. And then we have commands. I have used MVVM Lite, so I have used the relay command, but you could as well have built your own command implementation. So that is how the application is set up. All right, and then of course we have the view model, the unit test project that we're going to take a look at the end of the talk. All right, let's now take a look at the individual parts. So I'm using a DI container for the management of my dependencies. I want to achieve loose coupling. I want to achieve easy unit testing in the end. I want to make sure that I can easily pass in fakes, that I can easily pass in mock implementations of my services and whatever. So I'm going to use a DI container. So I'm going to manage every dependency in my application using a DI container. I'm not going to use concrete implementations in my application. I'm going to put them all in the DI container. That will actually help me achieve loose coupling. Now, in MVVM Lite, you have simple IOC. I find simple IOC a bit too simple, probably hence the name, mainly because I think that there's a couple of things that should be added in terms of lifetime management. Now, I've looked at some others on NuGet, and I found a couple of interesting ones. I used Metro IOC in this implementation. You have things like Tiny IOC. AutoFac also exists for Windows 8, so you can use whatever you want. And I use them for all my dependencies. I use them to manage my views, my view models, my services, all those things I put in my container. I let my container create the concrete implementations of my classes. Now, before we take a look at the implementation, what I also do is I create an abstraction on top of the container. Wouldn't it be ironic to actually evangelize the fact that you want loose coupling and then take a hard dependency on your DI container? I think so. So what I do is I build an abstraction layer on top of the container so that inside of the code that I'm writing, I don't have a dependency on the actual container. I only have a dependency on my container in just one class, the abstraction layer on top of the container. If the container needs to be changed afterwards, deciding that maybe I'm going to use simple IOC anyway, then I only have to change it in one location. All right, let's take a look at the use of the DI container. So let's take a look at the view model locator. I'm going to start there. So I put everything, so I register all the types inside of this view model locator. The reason I do that is that the view model locator is actually going to be called as the very first thing because I created an instance of it using the AppSAML. So that is why I'm sure that this code will actually be executed before anything else. So that's why I register all my types in here. So for example, here I'm using the class the instance factory, the register type. I create the link between the iTile service and the concrete implementation of the tile service. Same for views, same for view models. Now the instance factory, if you take a look, doesn't have anything to do with Metro IOC. It is code that I have in my application. Now the instance factory is the abstraction layer I was just mentioning in the slides. So this class is the abstraction layer on top of my Metro IOC container. It contains a reference to Metro IOC, as you can see here, but it doesn't. So I don't have dependencies on Metro IOC throughout my code. I managed them. I put them all in this one class. And here I have things like register a type, register with transient lifetime, so that's basically using a transient. In this application, I've used the register type almost all the time. I could have done it with transient lifetime, so basically the register type uses a singleton, so mainly basically returning always the same instance of the instance that I'm asking. If I use transient, I'm going to get a new instance every time I ask a new instance. I could have used for the detail pages, I could have used a transient. Yeah, again, it is not a perfect implementation. So I'm using the singleton every time. Now, this is how I put things in my container. If you take a look at how we use them in the container, let's take a look at the view models. So in the recipe group overview view model, so I have a dependency on my, I need my navigation service, my recipe data service, and my dialog service. We'll take a look at those in just a second. But I'm using my container to actually get an instance of these concrete classes. If I unit test this later on, and we'll do that at the end, we'll actually see that this is an easy way of doing this. Many people will say, why don't you use the constructor injection? I could have used constructor injection here. I choose not to. Well, it's the way I do it. It is certainly not the perfect way of doing it. There's room for improvement. All right. Let's take a look at navigation. Navigation in Windows 8 is a totally different thing. We've talked about that in the beginning. Windows 8 uses different concepts to navigate from Windows. Basically, the windows are now pages. They're full screen apps that they take the entire screen. And so navigation is also a totally different aspect. Basically, navigation is now more like a website in Windows 8. And also, if you've been doing Silverlight or if you've been doing Windows Phone, the concepts are more or less the same thing, the same as in Windows 8. So basically, what it's all about, the top window that you have, the one window that you have, that's a frame, and that contains a frame. And in that frame, the root frame, you're going to use pages. And the frame actually does the navigation from page 1 to page 2. It allows you to say, now I want you to go back, using the frame go back, and now I want you to go to this particular type using the frame.navigate. And if you've been doing Windows Silverlight development or Windows Phone development, Windows 8 actually supports navigation based on the type name, and you can also pass in an optional parameter. So that's possible as well with Windows 8. Now, what we do see here, however, is that we have to use the frame instance in our application to do the navigation. Now, that can be a problem if you use if you use MVVM, because you want to create view models that you can easily test. And you also want to create view models that do just what they have to do. And you don't want in your view models to create a dependency on anything that is view related. So things like a button you should never have in your view model. There are people that actually succeed in getting control instances in their view models. I don't know how they do it, but some people actually can do it. That is not a good thing. That's one of the things that you should never have. And also having a reference to the frame is more or less the same thing. You should not have a reference to the frame in your view model. Because then, again, it becomes hard to test that view model because you have a dependency on the visual element. However, navigation is somehow the task of the view model because the view model is concerned with the flow of the application. But it should not contain a reference to the frame. So should we do navigation then in the view? Well, certainly not, because the view is stupid. It doesn't do a thing. It just binds on the view model and that's it. And certainly not the model either. So how do we do navigation then? Well, we have to create something called a separate service. And a service is basically a class that is only concerned with one particular task, in this case, the navigation. And so in that separate class, in that separate service, we're going to create a dependency on the frame. And in our view models, we're going to create a dependency, or we're going to use that separate service, but we made it possible to actually test my view model without having an instance of the frame in there. It is possible to actually pass in a mock version of that separate service into my view model to test my view model in isolation. So I will manage that navigation service in my IOC container, and then that's how I pass it into my concrete implementation. Now, before we take a look at the demo, what about multiple windows? As mentioned in the beginning, you don't really have an MDI interface in Windows 8, so a multiple document interface, that doesn't really exist. But you do have things like dialogues. Message dialogues, confirmation dialogues, error dialogues that are basically an extra layer on top of this, on top of your UI that you do have. You don't want to create a dependency on message dialogues in your view models. However, it will be your view models that will have to create that exception or that dialog window or whatever. So we're going to create another separate service, the dialog service, that will actually be responsible to manage these things, put it in a container, and then call them from the view model. Let's take a look at this in a demo. So I have this navigation service. So let's go to the services project. And in the general here, I have my navigation service. And as you can see, as the very first thing, the navigation service is implementing the iNavigation service interface, and it contains a frame reference, or frame property, and that's not a problem, because I put it in a separate class that I can test, but it's not a task of my view model. My view model is not dependent on the frame. Then I say here, I also add this frame navigated to, I'm going to show the on-frame navigated in just a second, allowing me to do things like initialization of my view models. So then, I have a couple of overloads to do navigation. This is a very simple application. In the application itself, I use this type of navigation based on the page name, and then I call the navigate, the generic implementation of navigate over here, and that will actually do the navigation. So here we have the frame.navigate going to a particular view type, so an instance of a type, and also going, passing in an optional parameter. And that's how I do my navigation in a separate class. I also have this on-frame navigated. The on-frame navigated is going to be an event handler that's going to be called when we navigate it to a particular, to a new page on the frame level. And I can use that to, for example, call a view model initialization method. Sometimes you want to do stuff with your view model only when the user is on the page. You can do that with this on-frame navigated, which will actually be called when the view model is instantiated and navigated to. Now, in the another thing that you have here is how do you pass this frame instance to this navigation service? I do that in the AppXAML. So in the AppXAML.cs, in the onLaunched, I have this navigation service instance that I'm asking to my container. And then when the root frame is being created, I use the navigation service.frame and I set it to that root frame. So then I have my navigation service ready. So then I can use in my view models navigation. So I'm going to, for example, use the overview view model. And in the commands, I use my navigation service. And so I get my navigation service, of course, from the container. So and in the commands, I then use the navigation service.navigate to navigate to a particular view. Then my view models are doing the flow of the application. They're not doing the actual navigation of the application. That is the task of the individual navigation service. All right. That's it for navigation. Making a separate class, let that do the navigation, and let my view models call that separate class. Now, what about data access? Many applications require data. Windows 8 doesn't support local databases, so you're going to have to use some service that retrieves you the data. How can you actually do that data? There's a couple of things that I always do to access the data and to manage the data. I actually create a couple of extra layers for my data management. First, I create what is known as a repository. It is not a good thing to create a dependency between, or a hard link, let's say, between your data access code, your data persistence code, and your data consumer code. Your view model should not be concerned with accessing the data. Your view model should ask a class, yeah, give me back that data. That's not really true. I'm going to put another layer in between, but that's what it comes down to. The repository basically, repository pattern evangelizes the fact that you should create a separate class that separates the data persistence, or that abstracts the data persistence from the data consumer code. And that's your repository. Now, a repository often manages a single resource collection. Think of invoice and invoice lines, recipe groups and recipes. That is what is often managed in one single repository class. Now, in many applications, your data is not so clean that you can use the entities one-on-one in the UI. So your view model would actually have to talk to a repository of the invoices and maybe to the repository of the users. So that's not a good thing either. Think of separation of concerns. Your view model should only be capable of saying, I want this particular data now. And it's not going to ask to several repositories for the data. That's why you need another layer on top of that, and that is your data service. Data service can be seen as like your business layer. The business layer or the data service layer is going to be the one functionality unit. It's going to be created per unit of functionality, basically. For example, saying, I want all the invoices, and that goes out to the invoice repository and user repository and I don't know what. So it's going to combine all the responses in one, and it's going to give that back to the view model. And your view model is going to talk with this data service. The data service itself is going to talk with the repository. Another advantage that you get out of that is things like caching. Where do you do caching? Well, you do caching, in my opinion, on your repository layer. because the repository is the actual data persistence layer. And that could, for example, check first with an actual service for data, or and then download it, cache it. And the second request, it will look in the local cache and retrieve the data from cache. That is something that you should be doing on your repository level. We're going to do questions at the end, otherwise we're not going to get there. Okay? So, and that's the data service is then communicated with the view models. The view models communicate, sorry, the data service communicates with the actual repository layers. Let's take a look at the implementation. So I have this repository project here. And maybe the repository is not really a good example here because it's a bit too small, the application, to really manage as a repository. My microphone is getting... It's running away from me. So I have this recipe repository. Do you still have that tape to? Because my microphone doesn't like me anymore. So I have this recipe repository, and that does the actual data access for me. It will actually go out. Can you still hear me? No. Okay. 1 second. Technical pause. Thank you. Maybe here as well? No? Okay, thank you. All right, so let's do that again. So we have the repository. The repository does the actual data access. In the sample, it only goes out to a local file, gets the data, reads it from there. This is where I would do my service calls. This is where I would do my caching. So my cache lookup, give the data back from cache if I find it in the cache, otherwise get it from the actual service. Then I have my data service in the service project. So I have this recipe data service. And that recipe data service has directly uses my repository, as you can see here, so the recipe repository. I don't use an interface on my repository layer. I could have done it here. I have not done it. One important thing here on the, for example, get all recipe groups is the fact that there is an async in here. Why does this have to be an async? Well, I'll show you. Let's take a look at where we use this data service. So in the recipe group overview view model, for example, in the initialization of the view model, I have this recipe groups observable collection, which is going to be filled up with the recipe data service get all recipe groups. But this has to be an asynchronous call because this is actually the data that I'm going to be binding to. This would actually block my UI if I don't make an asynchronous API on my recipe data service. And that's how I do my data access. View model, data service, repository. All right. Let's take a look at the data mining stuff. So once we have the data in our application, we can start binding it. Now, data binding has been a very cool concept in XAML all along. And we can use most of the data binding principles that we know from other XAML technologies that in WinRT. Now, WinRT and Windows 8 contain a few new controls that are a bit more confusing, a bit more complex, let's say, than a regular list box or something. It contains new controls to display or to view lists of data. Things like RSS feed, Flickr images, even local files, they're all lists of data. And that's why Microsoft decided that they needed a couple of interesting new list controls, touch-optimized list controls. And those are the list view, the grid view, the flip view, and the semantic zoom controls. And we'll take a look at how we can use them in combination with MVVM. So I'm going to start with the grid view in the landing page of the application. Let me show you how I use that in combination with MVVM. So on my view model again, that's the one I still had open here. So I have this observable collection of iRecipe groups here at the top. That is where I will be binding to in my view. So the view model's task is making sure that the state is exposed on the view model so that the view can actually easily bind to it. That's what I'm doing here. I'm creating an observable collection of iRecipe groups that I'm going to be binding to. it's a demo. Real-life applications, you should probably make change your data somehow to make it in this format. In any case, what you want to be able to be binding to is, let's say, a list of lists. That's what the grouped grid view is going to expect. Groups, and then for these groups, you have your individual items. I mean, indeed, my recipe group contains the observable collection of recipes. That's what you see here. So that is my list of lists. So my list of recipe groups. Each recipe group contains a group of recipes. So the data is in an easy workable format. Let's take a look at the UI. So I'm going to go to the application itself, and I'm going to open the recipe group view. So in here, I have a semantic zoom. I'm going to come back to the semantic zoom in just a second. Let's first take a look at this grid view here. No, sorry. Let's first take a look here at the top. So the collection view source is created here. A collection view source that is binding to recipe groups. That was my observable collection on my view model. And I also use the items part property. And I use the items part property here to say what is going to be, let's say, the drill down property to take a look at the individual items. So that my control will know those are your groups and each group has a drill down property in recipes. And that's actually enough for the grid view. If you take a look at the grid view we have here, so I have this grid view, and it has an items source property, and that is set to the actual collection view source. Nothing more, nothing less. I also create an item template, and so on and so forth. That is basic XAML. So how does this thing know that we want to create a grouped grid view? That's always a difficult one to pronounce. So first I create a virtualizing stack panel as the items panel. That is saying to my grid view, you know, each group should be placed next to each other in a virtualizing stack panel. The orientation of this thing is set to horizontal, so I simply place all my groups next to each other. That's what you saw in the view. Then I also specify how an individual group should be created. Well, the group has a header, and the header has a button in there, and in that button, I'm binding that button to the title of the group. If we go back to the recipe group implementation, so the recipe group has indeed this title property that I'm going to be binding to. And if we run it, maybe let me run it quickly so that you know what we're talking about. So that is this button here that is binding to the title. And then I also have the group style panel, which is a variable sized rep grid. And that is, in fact, how the individual items are going to be shown in an individual group. So that is what you see here. And all those groups are placed in the virtualizing stack panel next to each other in a horizontal way. So that's basically how the grid view is binding to data exposed on the view model. Now, what if you want to add the semantic zoom? Well, let's take a look. So semantic zoom is a really cool concept. Windows 8 sometimes requires you to swipe a lot on the screen to actually get to the data that you want to see. And that's why they included something called semantic zoom. Semantic zoom allows you to do a two-level view of your data. So you have your regular view that we saw just a minute ago, but you can also zoom out to a higher level and from there get like a bird's eye perspective on your groups of data and then select a group and directly dive into that group. That's what the semantic zoom will allow you. So it basically contains two levels of data, a zoomed out level and a zoomed in level. In a semantic zoom control, you can place things that implement the iSemantic Zoom interface. Currently, there's two things available in WinRT that you can use for that. The iSemantic Zoom interface is implemented by the list view and the grid view. So you can only place things like that implement that interface inside of the semantic zoom. That is also why you cannot create a semantic zoom in a semantic zoom, because the semantic zoom itself doesn't implement the iSemantic Zoom interface. That's why you cannot put more than two levels. This is how it looks. We've already seen it in the sample. So for example, we have the store over there. And the thing on the right is, let's say, the high level view, so the overview. And then when we click on an individual category, we go to a more detailed view of that category. It is just a way of visualizing data differently. Now, it does create a couple of things in the view that we have to look out for. So if we go back to the collection view source, the collection view source contains the binding to the recipe groups and the items path, but it doesn't really say what are the group properties. Okay, that that sounds a bit of a problem. Let's go back to the semantic zoom. So the semantic zoom, zoomed in view, that is the regular view, that's the grid view that I've just shown you. The semantic zoom zoomed out view, collab this one. So the semantic zoom zoomed out view is the high level view of my data. Again, I used another grid view, as you can see here. And I used an item template, so a data template for that. But it seems that something is missing. It doesn't know actually what are the groups of my data. Is this something that is missing? Sometimes I think yes, sometimes I think no. Depends a bit on the day of the week, I think. In fact, your semantic zoom control in its zoomed in view could know what are the groups, but you have to specify to it. So that is why we have to write some code in the code behind. Does that matter? No. Because that is code that does things with the view. You can say, yeah, well, it seems that you're doing something with the model here. Well, that's not a problem. I'm using model items, but those model items were already exposed by the view model. I'm just doing something to display them correctly. So that should go in the view. And so what I'm doing here is I'm using this group grid view, item source. So that's the high level, that's a zoomed out grid view. And I'm going to say your item source is the grouped items view source, or the collection view source, dot view dot collection groups. And that then knows what are the groups. And so it knows what are its high level, what it should put in the high level overview of the data. Is that a problem that it goes here? No. It is not a sin to write this code in my code behind. All right. Let's take a look at contracts in Windows 8. Now, contracts are a really cool feature in Windows 8. If you've never seen contracts in Windows 8, well, what are they? Well, they allow us to, like a real-life contract, as a developer, say to Windows, you know, I'm going to do this and this and this if you do this and this and this for me. Like a real-life contract. You say, I'm going to buy your house, and I'm going to give you some money for it. That's basically what a contract also does. And in Windows 8, things are basically the same thing. You say that you're going to implement a specific contract, and because of the fact that you do that in your code, Windows is going to give you some advantages. There's a couple of contracts available in Windows 8. The search contract, the share contract, those are the most often used, and you also have things like the file picker contract, and there's also quite a lot of extensions. There's quite a lot, but how do you use them in combination with Windows 8? Might be a bit confusing how you can actually get them to work in combination with Windows 8. I picked the share contract to show you how I do that in my applications. So the share contract, what does it actually do? Normally when we want to share data from one application to another application, what do? We save something locally, or we copy it to the clipboard and then send it to another application. If you want to share something on Facebook, you save a picture locally and then you upload it to Facebook. That's how you do it. In Windows 8, the share contract makes that sharing principle a bit simpler. It makes it an out-of-the-box feature of your application if you implement it correctly. For that, Windows 8 has the share contract that works together with the share charm. It offers, in marketing terms, lightweight in-context sharing. Now, the lightweight is, in fact, pointing to the fact that it is really simple to do, and for the end user, I mean. For the in-context part, basically says you don't have to leave the application to actually do sharing. That's you stay in the context of the application. You don't save something to your desktop and upload it somewhere else. You stay in the application. Now, sharing is a bit of a special case in terms of contracts. It happens between two applications. One application shares something, another application has to accept it. And Windows sits in the middle. Windows is like your mediator between the two applications that are sharing data. You share something from one application, the source application, to another application. It all goes through the share pane. I'm going to show you that in just a second. One important aspect is that the sharing application, so the share source and the share target, do not have to know each other. As mentioned, Windows sits in between. It is more, again, like a pub/sub model. There is no way that you have to go talk with another developer. What are you expecting from me? No, that is all part of the contract. The contract decides on what can be shared between two applications. So how does this sharing actually work? So you have your source application, and that source application has to do stuff with Windows. Now, if you've been doing Windows 8 application development, some contracts, like the share contract, they require you to add a declaration to your application. If you are sharing data using the share contract, if you're the source application, you don't have to do that. The main reason is that sharing is dependent on the page in the application. For example, the overview of the recipes, it cannot share anything. I can only share from the detail page. So that is why I will have to, on a per page basis, decide if I can do sharing or not. So that is why in Windows 8, you don't have to add a declaration for your sharing if you're sharing as a source. So my source application, what it has to do, however, is on particular pages, say to Windows, you know what, I want to share here. Now sharing and saying to Windows you're going to share is done using the Data Transfer Manager. That should ring a bell now. That is, in fact, a dependency we're taking on a WinRT component. Again, difficult to test if we would write it in the regular way. So we're going to register with the data the transfer manager. We're going to register for the data requested event. The data requested event is going to be fired when the user says, share. I want to share something. Then your source application is going to get in that event. That event is going to be raised. And it starts to build up the data that it will share with the target application. It does that in something called the data package. The data package is like a box in which it drops all the data it needs to share. And it says to Windows, I'm done. It gives the box to Windows. Windows opens it and looks in the box. And what does it find? Maybe URI, maybe some images, maybe some text. And based on that, Windows will build up a list of applications that that data can be used by. So it's going to build up a list of applications in the share pane. And then the user selects an application from there, and that will be opened. And that that will be activated, I should say. And that will then get read access to the data package. That is how sharing works. Now, sharing in an MVVM implementation is a bit of a special case again, because we have the dependency on the Data Transfer Manager. And if we want to use the Data Transfer Manager, we are, again, creating a dependency on the WinRT component. And we should not be doing that. So that is why the sharing itself is going to be pushed in a separate class, in a separate service, and we're going to call that service from the view model, because it will be the view model that decides when or not we can do sharing. So let's take a look. So I have this share service over here. And that share service contains a couple of things. So what I'm going to share is a recipe. So in my share service, I have this property called shared recipe. I'm going to need to fill that up so that my share service knows what it will be sharing. I have this initialized in my shared service, and that is calling onto the Data Transfer Manager. It's calling the Data Transfer Manager get for current view, getting in the current instance of the Data Transfer Manager, getting that back from Windows, and then I'm subscribing for the data requested event. And in the data requested, that is code I copied from Contoso Cookbook, I'm building up the thing that I'm going to be sharing. So when I now want to use this thing, I'm going to go to my view model, and let's go to the recipe group detail view model now, because that is where I will be sharing. So selected recipe detail, recipe detail view model, I have this selected recipe property that I'm going to fill when I'm navigating to this particular view. And in here, I have the share service.shared recipe. So when I'm navigating to this page, I call onto my share service and I fill up its shared service property. This one. So then at that point, the application already knows what it will be sharing. This service knows. Now, I also, in my initialization, somewhere here at the bottom, call onto my share service.initialize. That will trigger the code that this page is going to register with the Data Transfer Manager. And then it will know that when the user clicks on share, it will handle the sharing completely for me. The view model doesn't have to interfere with the sharing, because this is not really part of the view model's task. It is part of the flow of the application to set it up. The view model will say, here we can share. But for the rest, it is not the task of the view model itself. And that's why I pushed it in a separate service. All right. Now, what about tiles? Tiles are a very important aspect in Windows 8. They are, in fact, allowing your application to show important information to the user even when the application is not running. There's several types of tiles. You have the actual static tiles, which are not really a live tile. And I do a talk on live tiles this afternoon if you want to, if you're interested in knowing more about tiles. You have wide tiles, you have square tiles, you have tiles that show an image, you have tiles that show text, you have tiles that don't update, you have tiles that update, so basic tiles and live tiles. Those are all several ways of showing information to the user. A tile can also work together with the cloud, and since it can work together with the cloud, it can be a way around the one app limitation. In Windows 8, every application that is not in the foreground gets suspended, and therefore it cannot show updates to the user anymore. Now, the live tiles and push notifications are going to be a way around the one app limitation, allowing your application to update the tile while it is not running, and therefore giving the user updates about what your tile is doing. And there are several types of tiles, like I mentioned. You can do tile updates locally, so meaning from code, directly from code. So you run your code, your application is running, it can update the tile. It can also create scheduled updates from there so that the tile update will appear only after a certain amount of time. But you can also integrate the cloud, and there's two ways of doing that. You can create a periodic tile and a push notification. A periodic tile will update at a specific interval. Basically, you're registering or you're creating a tile that will go out to a service and pull that service every now and then for updates. That's a pulling mechanism in your tile. You can also create a breaking news application that requires push notifications, where the actual server side will push information to the client, to the Windows 8 application, and therefore triggers a tile update on the client. Those are the several types of updates that you can do in your application. I'm going to show you local updates and push notifications in combination with MVVM. Again, a local tile update, so meaning that your application is running when it's doing its tile update, is something that should be triggered from the view model, but it's not a responsibility of the view model. It is something that the view model will say, now we're going to do a tile update, but we're going to push it again in a separate class. Let's start by looking at the code for this. So I have this tile service over here, and it is using it actually exposes two methods, a send simple text update and a send image and text update. So the send simple text update, if you take a look at this code, it is using something called the notifications extensions library. The notifications extensions library, which sits over here, I'm going to discuss this evening, in the last session of today. It is as separate SDK library that is a wrapper around the XML that has to be sent to a tile update. In order not to write XML to update your tile, you're going to use these classes. I'm going to use these classes all the time because they're much easier to work with than with plain XML strings. So what I'm going to do here in this send simple text update, I'm going to create something called an iTileWideTextO3, which is a wrapper around a particular tile template. And I set its text. I also set what is going to be updated on the square text. In any case, I then, in the end, sent this tile update to something called the tile update manager, which manages the tiles of my application. In my actual application, let's kill this and let's open the recipe detail view model again. So the implementation here is pretty simple. When I navigate to the detail page, I will update the tile. So in this setter of the selected recipe, I will call the tile service send simple text update. My view model is going to manage the fact that we want to do a tile update, but it's not doing it itself. I push that responsibility into the tile service. And we're free. The tile service is doing the updates, the local tile updates. My view model is pushing the tile update, but it's not depending. And I will be able to mock out my tile service in the end. Now, what if, so that is local tile updates. Now, what if you want to do push notifications? A push notification is entirely managed, entirely pushed, let's say, from the cloud. But your application does have to do a couple of things to start receiving push notifications. Let's take a look at the schema for push notifications. It actually is an interaction between your application and the cloud. So on one hand, you have your application, and that application says, I'm interested in receiving push notifications from the cloud. So what it will do first, it will register with something called the client notification platform, and the client notification platform is part of Windows. And it will say to that client notification platform, please let me receive push notifications. And that client notification platform will take a look at the application and say, okay, here is like your permission slip to receive push notifications in the form of something known as a channel URI. A channel URI is a very long URI that uniquely identifies your application on that device for that user. So that is how Windows will actually figure out what device it should send the update to. So the channel URI, you have to upload that to your own server side. Your service side is a service that you write, maybe in Windows Azure, and it will maintain a list of all connected clients. So all the channel URIs are going to be pushed to that channel service. That will save them in a local database. Now, when something triggers on the backend, when an event fires, that will notify the service, and then it says to that service, you know what, we need to push an update to all connected clients. Something happened, breaking news application, we need to push an update to all connected clients. So then that will go to the database and loop through the database, return all the channel URIs, and for each channel URI it finds, it will actually push an update to something known as WNS, Windows Notification Service. So it will update, it will push an update to Windows Notification Service for every instance of the channel URI it finds. It does a post, and then WNS itself will go out, find the device based on the channel URI, and send the tile update to the client. And it will then update the tile. And that is how you can actually go around the one app limitation, because your application doesn't have to run to make tile to make receiving push notifications possible. Your application doesn't have to run, it simply registers. Now, how do you do this in combination with push notifications in MVVM? So I have this push notification service, and remember what we said here. So the actual application only communicates with the client notification platform and then sends it off to a service. In the push notification service, I'm doing exactly that. My application is going to register with the client notification platform. That's the first line you see here. So the Windows networking push notifications, push notification channel manager dot create push notification channel for application async. I think it's a battle at Microsoft to create the longest method name or something. Anyway, that retrieves us the channel URI, and that is that long URI. And then I'm going to go out to my service that is actually in the services project, and I'm going to register that service with the endpoint listening on the server side. That will store it in a database, and when something then happens on the server side, it will push that to my client. And again, for the rest, my application is totally not involved with this. I simply do this, maybe on application startup, or when the user says, I want to receive new push notifications, but for the rest, my application is not bothered with this. This is totally pushed out of the functionality of my application. All right, we have two more things to do, so we should be there right on time. Now, what about lifecycle management? Windows 8 applications have a new process lifecycle. Normally, we're used to the fact that the user closes an application when he's finished with it. In Windows 8, that model is gone, basically. The user switches applications. That application automatically enters what is known as suspended state. And that suspension can actually cause a bit of a headache sometimes. Let me first start by showing you the flow of the process lifecycle in Windows 8. So Windows 8 application is initially not running. The user taps on a tile in the start screen, and that will launch the application. It will enter the running state. Everything is happy, happy, joy, joy for the application. It runs, it does whatever it wants, and all of a sudden the user says, you know what, I'm done with you, I'm going to do something else. So the user switches applications. After a couple of seconds, that application enters the suspended state. There is an event raised about this, known as the suspending event, and the unsuspending, but in any case, your application enters the suspended state, and the net result of that is that the application is not capable of running any code anymore. So it's not running in the background. It is basically suspended. It can't do anything with the CPU, with the disk, or the network. Now, from there, the application can be resumed. It is possible that the application enters the running state again. That basically is not a problem. But what is a problem is the fact that from the suspended state, the application can also be terminated. If Windows decides that there's too many applications running, it will start killing off suspended applications. And you don't know if your application is going to be part of that massacre or not. Your application might be terminated or not. Now, the main idea here in Windows 8 is that the user should not be bothered with all this. The user, when he leaves an application and he comes back to it, and the application was terminated, we are responsible to restore the state of the application as it was before. So that means that we may have to do things like restoring the page on which we were. For example, if the user was on a detail page of a recipe, we have to navigate back to that detail page of that recipe. If the user has entered data on the page, we may have to restore that data on the page. So that is things that we have to do. Most of the time, managing the state is done using the Application Data API. Application Data API allows you to save data locally in, let's say, a local folder for the application. You can also do, so from there you can do local folder of local settings. Local folder is basically a folder. Local settings is basically a dictionary that's associated with the application and that is serialized for you. You can also use roaming settings, but that's basically the same. Roaming settings will automatically sync with the cloud. The main idea is that your application should always make sure that if it gets terminated, that it knows what the user was doing, so that when it was terminated, it can automatically restore that. Now, if we take a look at how I manage this in my application, I have this state service. And maybe disclaimer, this is not complete, let's say. There is, again, room for improvement. The state management that I've put in here is that when we are on a detail page and the user kills the application, Windows terminates the application and the user returns to the application, the application will automatically navigate to that same detail page again. So what I have here, I have these methods, these two methods are important here. I have the save state and the load state. So the save state will use the local settings and it will actually save two values, on which view where we were and on the parameter that we were using. For example, the recipe ID that we were using or that we were viewing on the recipe detail page. I'm going to save that, and I'm also going to be able to restore that. Now, in my detail of the on my detail view model over here, I have this state service call that I'm doing. I'm going to say, dear state service, I want you to remember that we are now on the detail view, so on the detail page, and I have this selected recipe.unique ID as the parameter I want you to save. So my ID is that when the user now, when the application is terminated and the user returns, I'm going to navigate again to this application with this recipe ID. How do I do that? In my app XAML over here, there we go. So in my app XAML, in the on launched, you can check the previous application execution state. And Windows will actually let you know if your application was previously terminated. By checking this value of the argument's previous execution state, you can check if you were terminated. What I'm then going to do is I'm going to ask my state service, please load the state. And if I find these two values, I'm going to ask my navigation service to navigate automatically back to that particular view and pass in that recipe ID. And that's how I manage state. Very simple. Now, one thing that this doesn't do, maybe you can add it yourself and let me know. One thing that this doesn't do is restoring the navigation history. You should be able to navigate back to the home page and maybe restore the entire stack in a more complex application. This application restoring is basically only having a back button, but in a real application, you should maybe also save the navigation history so that you can actually navigate back, because it is the goal of making sure that the application was in the state that it was before. All right, so we have a couple of more minutes left, so we're going to use the unit testing part. So the unit testing, I've made my application so that it is possible to unit test it quite easily. I've used dependency injection. I've used separation of concerns to make sure that I can unit test things quite easily. I'm going to create some fake implementations of a couple of things to make it possible, for example, to test my view models. Let me show you. So in here, what I'm going to try to unit test is this particular thing here. So in the recipe detail view model, sorry, recipe group detail view model, so the detail page of a recipe group, I have this initialize method over here. And this initialize method is, well, it is going to ask the recipe data service to get all the recipe groups and then get the one that contains a particular ID that I pass in via the parameter. Now, this recipe group detail view model has two dependencies, the navigation service and the recipe service. So I need to unit test this now. So in my test project over here, I'm using Microsoft's unit testing framework. So I make this a test class, and I use this class initialize. And in this class initialize, I'm going to do two things first. I'm going to use my instance factory register type to register two fake implementations of both my navigation service and my recipe data service. So as you can see here, I've written a fake recipe data service, and I've also written a fake navigation service. Let's take a look at the fake recipe data service. It implements, of course, the iRecipe data service, and it uses a fake repository that has a recipe groups observable collection. Now, my fake repository, my fake recipe repository, I've written some code in there that contains, in this case, a hard-coded list of some possible recipes that I'm returning in this, sorry, in, oops, that's not one, in my fake recipe data service over here. So I'm returning here my new fake repository, recipe groups. That's what I'm going to return from there. In the test itself, over here, I registered these two with my instance factory so that I now know from my unit test my two fakes are going to be used. Now I have my actual test method. So I'm actually going to call, I'm going to instantiate my recipe group detail view model. I'm going to pass it the parameter Chinese, and I'm going to check that indeed my selected recipe group is not null, and I know that in my fake recipe data service, I've written a fake recipe group that has the ID Chinese. And that's how I unit tested my application, of course. You have to write some more unit tests, and this might be a bit too simple, but I hope I've given you the entire picture here. So we're out of time. We're just out of time, so that it's time to wrap things up. So what I hope I've given you here is an overview of some more advanced concepts of MVVM, that you are also convinced that building applications with MVVM is certainly a good idea, and it is now time to go out and build your next big thing, but then in a better way. Thank you for being here, and I hope you enjoyed it. Maybe one more thing. If you have questions, by the way, simply come up here. If you want to read more on this topic, I've written three articles that basically go a bit further in this actual demo. I've put them on silverlightshow.net. So if you want to read everything that I've told you here, and more, there's a couple of concepts that I didn't have the time to show. They are explained on that article series as well. So thank you for joining, and enjoy the rest of the day. Thanks.